My guest today, Sasan Fayyamanesh, is a professor emeritus at economics at Cal State University in Fresno. He's the author of The United States and Iran, Sanctions, War, and the Policy of Dual Containment, published in 2008 by Routledge. And his articles have appeared in Counterpunch, Monthly Review, and other respected journals, and was a guest on Takes on the World some years back. In 2006, he was honored by former Trotskyist and darling of the ultra-right, David Horowitz, as one of the 101 most dangerous academics in America. Sounds like our kind of guy. Welcome, Professor Fayyamanesh, to Takes on the World.
Many thanks, Jeff.
Yes, I like that you're naming on that list there. I know Horowitz from way back. Let's start with the latest news. There are reports this morning from the meeting in Baghdad between the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, the so-called P5 plus one, and Iran, that the Iranian representatives were presented with a new package of demands and inducements aimed at limiting its nuclear program. And the negotiations, according to unnamed Western officials, presumably American, are seeking to build on a tentative agreement reportedly reached Monday between Iran and the UN International Atomic Agency chief Yuki Amano that would allow international inspectors access to sites, scientists, and documents that the quote-unquote West believes are related to an alleged Iranian nuclear weapons program. These seem to be important concessions. What's your take on this current news?
I'm not sure what where you were reading this report, but it's
the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, okay, and that explains it. I am following it very closely. The meeting just ended, and it's actually unclear what were proposed by both sides, from the Iranian news agencies and the media that I'm reading. I can gather that both sides proposed what they call packages, and the details of the packages are unclear. This really didn't have much to do with Amano's visit to Iran on Monday. We just have to wait and see what comes out of the meeting, and they are scheduling another meeting for tomorrow. So it was supposed to be one day, but it has been extended to 2 days now. But as I said, details are quite unclear.
One of the things that appears to me, and has even come out in the mainstream press, that one of the reasons that the U.S. as well as the Europeans have been pressuring Iran is to keep Israel from launching an attack. And even Ehud Mubarak, the defense minister, has just been quoted today as saying, even if Iran opens its nuclear facilities for inspection, that would not preclude an Israeli attack. Is this a case of international extortion and blackmail?
To some extent, Israel has been threatening Iran for nearly 10 years now, threatening it with an attack. But I've been watching it very carefully, and from that I can say that for the most part what they are trying to achieve is harsher and harsher sanctions. It is a form of blackmail and extortion in the sense that they are pushing the world community to bring about greater and more massive sanctions on Iran. There is, of course, always a possibility of an attack, but I don't think that they are going to go alone on this attack. So the purpose is to gather more and more sanctions on Iran.
Well, the sanctions have been draconian, and from all reports that have been available, it has really understandably hurt the Iranian economy. But going down the line, the sanctions, the European sanctions about receiving oil from Iran also are likely to threaten the European economy, which is on itself on the brink. I read an article a week ago in which the Europeans are now thinking twice about those sanctions and considerably thinking about easing them. And with Sarkozy gone from France, do you think there's a likelihood that that sanction arrangement will be changed? The Europeans can't afford to pay higher prices for oil on the open market, for sure.
Yes, you know, I've been watching these sanctions for nearly 33 years. And I have to say that the sanctions have become intensified, actually, as you said, draconian under the Obama administration, first of all. I've never seen sanctions the way that the Obama administration has been pursuing them in Iran. So they have been actually successful. The Europeans have, of course, joined, and they are supposed to implement basically a boycott of Iranian oil by July 1st. But given the economy of Europe, particularly the countries who were dependent on Iranian oil, such as Greece and Italy and Spain, given their dependence, it is going to really hurt the European economy. As of the time being, it is supposed to be implemented, but we have to wait and see what happens by July 1st. Of course, the Americans, the Obama administration, had similar sanction with regard to the Central Bank of Iran, as well as the boycott of the Iranian oil, and that has already been implemented by the Obama administration.
Before I call you on the phone, I reported on the two pieces, recent pieces of legislation passed by the U.S. Congress, the one that reaffirmed the U.S.-Israel relations and call for Israel to become part of NATO, and the one most recently last Thursday, which passed by a 401-11 vote, which pretended that U.S. policy was preventing, that Obama's administration policy was to prevent Iran from even having the capability of having a nuclear weapon, which is a Netanyahu position, and voted to reinforce the position which they said incorrectly and dishonestly that Obama has. But it would seem likely that given the election season reaching its height, that Obama would bend to that position as well. As you've written, that Obama basically has followed through on what he has promised in speeches before AIPAC.
Yes, exactly. This issue of whether Iran has to end its so-called supposedly nuclear weapons program or nuclear capability or nuclear weapons capability. There are differences here. Because if you go by the nuclear weapons capability, Iran is already capable. In other words, Iran has more than 5,000 kilograms of enriched uranium, which supposedly is enough for 5 nuclear bombs. So Iran has already passed the issue of nuclear capability. And what is being pushed in the U.S. Congress by lobby groups, but particularly AIPAC, is that Iran cannot have this nuclear weapons capability, which basically means that Iran has to stop all enrichment. This is not a position that is going to be accepted by Iran. President Obama himself mentioned that in his 2007 speech at AIPAC. He did talk about nuclear weapons capability that Iran cannot have. But at that time, it wasn't quite clear what he's saying. Nowadays, it has become quite clear that what they are saying is that Iran cannot enrich uranium whatsoever. And as I said, this is not acceptable to Iran.
Well, one of the problems that we see is this one-sided, lopsided argument, if you will, being made in Congress and in the media, which seems to be the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, has its op-ed pages open to any politician, be Israeli or American, who is calling for an attack or threatening Iran. And the three stooges, the influential stooges in the U.S. Senate, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and Joe Lieberman, have written, they've just written again, that even if Iran capitulates, it says, it will require much more than shuttering underground enrichment facility at Fordo, removing from Iranian territory all uranium enriched to 20%, spending further enrichment at that level, the three steps that report suggested, the P5 plus one negotiators will emphasize in Baghdad, that's not enough. They talk about Iran being the big supporter of terrorism. It's like they're looking, of course, for regime change, which has been on a neocon agenda for a long time. Given this drive toward war, literally war, although sanctions is a form of warfare, what do you think the possibilities are that there will actually be an attack by either Israel and Iran, or excuse me, Israel and the United States on Iran's facilities?
We might have to backtrack a little bit, and I explain the issue of the 20% enrichment at Fordo. And all that. But that actually needs quite a bit of training. But as far as attacking Iran, if you follow Obama's arguments, especially the past few speeches that he has made about Iran, he has been basically saying that the war in Iran is immature. So the question is, what does he mean by being immature? And my answer is that as of the time being, U.S. is in not a condition to start another war in the Middle East, that especially with Iran, as a more than 70 million population, and it's far bigger than Iraq. So that doesn't seem to be a possibility for the time being. Israel, of course, has been pushing U.S. in that direction. They pushed the Bush administration all the way to the end of their term to attack Iran, but it didn't happen. So the attacks, for the time being, I don't take them seriously. But we can go back and talk about what you were talking with regard to the underground facility and the 20% enrichment. As you mentioned, there are certain senators in the U.S. Congress, such as Lieberman, Kyle and Kirk, and certain representatives such in the House, such as Eliana Rasletinen, Bremen and Sherman, and so on and so forth. These individuals have been basically surrogates of the Israeli lobby group in the U.S. Congress. And they have been pushing for that issue that you raised earlier concerning Iran not having any nuclear weapons capability. And they have also been pushing the meetings that you were referring to earlier in that direction. That is to say, for example, to tell Iran that they have to stop enriching at the level of 20% and export or get rid of their whatever they have already produced at the 20% level. Now, what does that mean? The issue is that Iran has a nuclear reactor in Tehran, and that nuclear reactor produces medical isotopes. And that requires enriching uranium for about 20% level. And the Obama administration and the Iranian government had certain meetings with regard to that. Iran asked for enriched uranium at 20% level. The Obama administration basically ultimately refused to give them. And Iran said that we can produce it ourselves. And they have been doing that. They have been enriching to that level, and they have been actually using that uranium in order to produce nuclear rods and nuclear plates for the reactor in Tehran to produce medical isotopes. So that is not something that they are going to give up. Another demand of the Israelis that has been pushed by the individuals that you were mentioning in the U.S. Congress is to close an underground enrichment facility called Fordo, which is near Qom in Iran. Iran has been arguing that since it is being under threat continuously by U.S. and Israel, they have taken some of their enrichments underground. And it doesn't really make sense for them to close that underground facility. So if these P5 plus 1 keep pushing in that direction, there would be no result reached. I don't know if I answered your question, but there is tremendous amount of information out there.
No, the other one thing that strikes me as well is in all this discussion about Iran and the possibility of a U.S. or Israeli strike on Iran, the question of international law and the justification for such a strike is never discussed.
Exactly. What Iran has been arguing is that they have to go by the framework of NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is the framework that has to be followed, which basically gives its fourth article particularly, gives Iran the right to enrich uranium for producing nuclear energy. So the push by the U.S., European, and Israel against Iran and for Iran to stop any enrichment is against NPT. According to international law, you cannot threaten another country while they haven't really done anything to you. So, yes, actually, once you look at the Iran and U.S. relationship, you realize that in 1980, after the so-called hostage crisis, and after Iran nationalized certain corporations involving U.S. corporations, U.S. and Iran signed an agreement in 1980 in Algiers. It is called the Algiers Accord, in which Iran accepted to pay reparation to the U.S. corporations for nationalization of some of them and release the hostages. And U.S. on the other side agreed never to interfere in Iran's affairs again. And United States never abided by that agreement. Iran did, but the U.S. never did. So, yes, basically much of what they're doing is against international law.
Actually, one could make the argument that Iran would be justified in attacking Israel if it could, because what we've heard consistently over the past year or a couple of years are threats by Israel to attack Iran. Of course, we recently have seen a group of former generals and intelligence officers question the sanity of Mubarak and Netanyahu. Perhaps if they're sincere, they realize a catastrophe for the world that would eventually reflect on Israel should Israel launch an attack on Iran. What do you see about the significance of the dissent among the former Israeli generals and intelligence officers?
They make sense in the sense that Netanyahu, as well as Ehud Barak, have continuously argued that the Iranians are irrational. In other words, there can't be an agreement with Iran similar to, let's say, the agreement between the U.S. and Russia concerning nuclear weapons. So you cannot trust the Iranians according to them, and they are irrational. And therefore, we might have to attack them and destroy their nuclear facilities. On the other side, some intelligence officers or ex-Mossad heads have been arguing that that argument doesn't make any sense, that the Iranians or the Iranian government is actually quite rational after its own interest and all that, and some sort of agreement is possibly reachable. So, yes, there is this skirmish going on in Israel within the Israeli government as well. And the same argument, of course, has been going on between the Israeli government and the U.S. government, to the extent that the U.S. government, too, according to National Intelligence Estimate, which was put out in 2007 and then again in 2011, and it was repeated this year, the Iranian government is actually quite rational. So that's the discussion going on. Yes.
My guest is Professor Sasan Fayaz Manesh, and we are, of course, talking about Iran. What's interesting is most Americans are not aware across the board that there actually is opposition, not on the left, I mean, visible, but within the American establishment to the sanctions of Iran. And back in 2001, before 9/11, you wrote an interesting article Which is available on the web, called The Politics of the U.S. Economic Sanctions Against Iran, in which you described how the corporations, American corporations that make business overseas, have opposed Iran's sanctions from the beginning. And you mentioned the National Foreign Trade Council and its lobbying group, USA Engage, which lobbied unsuccessfully against the sanctions. And in checking their websites, I see that these groups have still been consistent lobbying against Iran sanctions, saying that doing business with a country and diplomacy is a much better way of keeping peace. And yet, their statements never appear in the mainstream newspaper or even the alternative media. And we hear the power of corporations in America, and we know they're very powerful. And I just recall to listeners that back in 1985, the first free trade agreement was negotiated between Israel and the United States, and it was opposed by Monsanto, Dow Chemical, the farm bureaus of every state in the country. Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas was protecting his bromine trade. And on the other side, we had AIPAC and Israel, and who won. Perhaps you'd comment on this whole subject and of the power of the lobby. You're one of the few academics who have the courage and guts to actually talk about it.
Yes, actually, in the late years, the last years of the Clinton administration, there was a fight going on between two powerful lobbies. One was the corporate lobby, and the other one was the Israeli lobby. The Israeli lobby, especially AIPAC, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, they're pushing for more and more sanctions as they are doing today. The corporate lobby, on the other hand, was losing quite a bit of business with Iran. This was especially the oil companies, the agricultural industry, as well as the aerospace, Boeing, and so on and so forth. They were using a lot of business in Iran, and they were trying to stop the Israeli lobby from putting forward more and more sanctions. So USA Engage, that you mentioned, was formed in 1997 as a counterweight to Israeli policy. And for a while, the Clinton administration, under Madeleine Albright leadership, tried to cater, let's say, to the corporate lobby. And that lasted only for a year or two, and it didn't last for too long. They were pushed aside by the Israeli. They completely lost to the lobby, to AIPAC particularly. As you said, they are still alive. They are still writing articles and trying to slow down these sanctions, but with very little success, almost none whatsoever.
I mean, it should
what
be.
Is,
sure. Go on, yes.
Hey, more than the corporations losing money and business in Iran, what is more important from the perspective of an economist is what the American people are actually losing in this battle. Because you look at the price of oil in 2003, before U.S. invaded Iraq, the price of oil was in the 20s, close to $30 per barrel. A few weeks ago, price of oil was at $126 per barrel. It has, of course, slightly gone down in the past few days, but it is still above $100. So this is very much caused by the turmoil that is being created by U.S. and Israel in the Middle East. Particularly as an economist, I watch the correlationship between the oil prices and these threats of attacks against Iran. And that has been pushing the oil prices higher and higher. And the American people see it as at the gas pumps. They see in California, they see nearly $4 per gallon of gas. That is the direct result of the turmoil that has been created in the Middle East, particularly with regard to Iran.
Well, obviously, both Iran and actually Saddam Hussein would have been more than happy to have the Western oil companies come in and make money at the same time providing money for the countries. And I think the last company that had a deal with Iran was Conoco, and they were forced to cancel it. And since oil companies have such a bad reputation in this country, it's very difficult for them to publicly lobby against sanctions. It's a losing proposition, and the American public and, of course, the European and Japanese around the world are the ones who are paying for this.
Right, exactly. Conoco lost in 1990s during the Clinton administration about $1 billion worth of investment in Iran. And as a result of Iran not having access to U.S. technology and then subsequently to the European technology, their refineries have been getting worse and worse, falling apart basically. And Iran is now is producing almost nearly half of what the oil that was being produced under the Shah's regime in 1970s. Nearly half of the capacity of the oil that was produced over 30-something years ago. So, yes, Iran has been very willing and to have U.S. and European oil companies come to Iran to develop these oil fields as well as the refineries, but they can't really get it. So that is the price that the American people are basically paying at the pump.
To change the subject, because I know listeners would be interested in hearing this, there has been a great deal of talk or criticism of the Obama administration on the part of Republicans and the Democratic Israel firsters that the U.S. administration did not do more to help the Iranian Green Movement in 2009 after the elections. And you wrote an interesting, a very important article in Counterpunch in 2010 bewailing the fact that Iranian Greens had forgotten their history and were begging the United States to do something to support democracy in Iran. Perhaps you could tell our listeners your thoughts about that. As a critic of the administration, yeah.
Right. Actually, a few weeks ago, we had a panel of experts on Iran, and I was attacked for not supporting the Iranian Green Movement and not asking the U.S. government to support human rights in Iran. And my answer was that charity begins at home. We have to start with the U.S. respecting human rights across the world, which is something that they really haven't done. Look at the atrocious policies that the U.S. has followed, for example, in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past few years. So if the U.S. starts to respect human rights around the world, then some of these countries, such as, for example, Iran or Egypt or whatever, they too might follow suit and see U.S. as an example. But as long as U.S. is following the policies that they have been pursuing, it is very hard to demand Iran to respect human rights, and it is harder to see how U.S., whose friends are Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Jordan, such a country can bring about human rights and democracy to Iran. That doesn't seem to be possible. Another issue is that the U.S. and Israel had no problem with the Shah of Iran when he was in power, and he was as brutal, perhaps, as the current regime in Iran, perhaps even worse. They had absolutely no difficulty with that individual then. So This issue of human rights and democracy in Iran seems to be mostly a red herring.
It's also interesting, as the so-called Lockerbie bomber, the questions whether he was responsible or not passed away. We've heard so much about the bombing of Lockerbie and the victims of Lockerbie, and yet we never hear anything except maybe a passing notice about the 288 Iranians who were deliberately shot and killed by an American destroyer in 1988. And the captain who ordered the firing, the commander, only received a promotion rather than a demotion. And maybe you could comment on the the hypocrisy, the way these two crimes were treated.
Yes, actually, I wrote another piece, I think, on the 30th anniversary of, can't remember exactly, of that event in 1988. And I have received quite a bit of response to that. I still receive responses to the article that I wrote for Counterpunch as to exactly what happened in that particular flight. But yes, you are right, over 200 people died in that attack. That was at the time when the U.S. was fighting on behest of Saddam Hussein against Iran. In other words, they wanted Iran to be defeated in the Iran-Iraq war, and they started to directly engage Iran on behest of Saddam Hussein in 1986 to 88. And the culmination of that defense of Saddam Hussein was shooting a civilian airliner, Flight 655, if I remember correctly, and killing all on board. To this day, they claim that it was merely a mistake, but from the perspective of Iranians, it was probably more than a mistake, that they, if it was an intention, intentionally done, it was as the result of all the fighting that was going on between the U.S. and Iran at the time.
Well, it's interesting that, as they say, that it's barely a footnote. Most Americans have no idea of the history of UN relations, although Hillary Clinton did mention the other day about what happened in 1953 and the overthrowing of Mossad.
One of the good questions that I was asked a few weeks ago by a reporter was, what is it that Israel and the U.S. want from Iran? And my answer was that the U.S. is after domination, is hegemonic. It can't stand anybody defying that hegemony. The other, as far as Israel is concerned, they seem to be after greater Israel. In other words, annexation of the West Bank. And Iran is one of the few countries that is standing in the way, and they want to get rid of that. In other words, as far as they are concerned, definitely it's the issue of regime change.
We've just come to the end of a very interesting hour with Professor Sasan Fayez-Banesh speaking about Iran. There's much more to talk about, and I want to do this again with you. Thank you. Thank you, Professor, for being our guest again today on Takes on the World, enlightening us on the situation between Iran and the U.S. and Israel, and hopefully it will be a peacefully resolved before we speak again. So again, thank you so much for being on the air today with Takes on the World.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.